Ben Smith, I'm a photographer, and this is my podcast, A Small Voice, Conversations with Photographers. Thanks for listening. Hello folks, this is Ben, this is A Small Voice, Conversations with Photographers, my podcast. Welcome along. I'm happy to say that my guest this week is Rich Joseph Facoon, and I will introduce Rich properly in a second. Little bit of business first of all. One quick sponsorship, which is of course the good old Charcoal Book Club, the monthly subscription service for photo book enthusiasts that brings essential limited edition and hard to find photo books to your doorstep. Actually, that is how come I am familiar with Rich's book, Black Diamonds, and it's kind of coincidental because I invite whoever I want onto this podcast. It's got nothing to do with the fact that Charcoal are a sponsor, but it so happens that Black Diamonds was a book of the month quite recently on Charcoal Book Club, and as a member, I got that through the post. And that's how come I became aware of Rich, and having seen that book, I decided that it'd be great to ask him to come on, and I'm happy to say that he agreed. So there you go. It all fits together, doesn't it, sometimes? And that has happened a few times with Charcoal Book Club. So have a look at the website, charcoalbookclub.com. Each month, if you join up, you receive a new museum quality first edition monograph, just like Black Diamonds, to add to your shelves, handpicked by Charcoal's team of expert curators and signed by the artist. So you get free shipping to UK, Canada and US. And like I say, you can have a look at some of the previous books of the month at charcoalbookclub.com. The best way to stay up to date with essential work in contemporary photography. What else? Please sign up as a member at pod.fan and help support the ongoing production of this podcast for the princely sum of £5 per month, and you will get in return exclusive subscriber only content only available to those people who I'm very happy to say will give me that donation. Well, it's not a donation, it's a subscription. You know what I'm saying. £5 a month, two cups of coffee. Pod.fan is where you can find the page for this podcast and sign up there. That's about it. So let me introduce Rich. Rich Joseph Facoon is a photographer of indigenous Mexican and Filipino descent. His work aims to offer an authentic look into endangered, bygone and fringe cultures, those transitions in time where places fade but people persist. The exploration of place, community and cultural identity presents itself as a common denominator in both his life and photographic endeavours. Before finding home in the Appalachian foothills of southeast Ohio, Rich roamed the globe for 15 years working as a photojournalist, and during that time he was sent on assignment to over a dozen countries. For three of those years he was based in the United Arab Emirates. His photography has been commissioned by various publications including NPR, The Atlantic, New York Times, Wall Street Journal and The Guardian, among others. And additionally, Rich's work has been recognised by Photo Lucida's Critical Mass, CNN, Juxtapose, British Journal of Photography, Washington Post and Pictures of the Year International. In 2021, Rich's first monograph, Black Diamonds, was released by Full Line Press. The work is a visual exploration of the former coal mining boom towns of southeastern Ohio, Appalachia. Subsequently, it was highlighted by Charcoal Book Club as their book of the month. I've already told you that. Black Diamonds is also part of the permanent collection at the Frederick and Kazuko Harris Fine Arts Library and the Amon Carter Museum of American Arts Research Library. Having successfully run a Kickstarter campaign which met the target funding, Rich is now in the process of producing his next monograph, Little Cities, slated to be released very soon by Little Oak Press. And the work examines how both indigenous people and descendants of settler colonialists inhabited and utilised the land around them. So that's Rich. I hope you enjoy this chat we had. Also, if you are listening the week that this has gone out, Rich is doing a takeover over on the Instagram page. So Ben Smith Photo is the Instagram handle. Have a look there at the post that Rich is going to be putting up this week, assuming you are listening Wednesday the 17th of August or thereafter. And please enjoy this chat that I had with Rich Joseph Facoon. Where are you? You at home?
No, I went into town because where I live, it's pretty rural, so I call it country net, because it's not broadband. It's I don't even know what it is, but it's not the best for doing these types of interviews. Mm. So I came into town, and they have a library here, and I got a quiet room.
Oh, okay.
And their internet's much better, so they actually have broadband. So
yeah.
So I'm located in Millfield, Ohio. So our population there is about 350.
Right. Tell me a little bit about it then, because I know this, it's very much relevant to the work that you do. It's you base your work around the area that you are talking about. Give us a little kind of flavor of what Millfield's like.
Well, it's located in the foothills of the Appalachian Mountains here in Southeast Ohio. It's a lot of just gravel back roads and a lot of windy. You would, maybe they're two lane roads, sort of, you know, if you go slow and, you know, as you're passing your neighbor, lots of hills. And right now it's one of my favorite times of the year because spring is bringing back all the green, and it's almost a vibrant glowing green of trees and land. And then, lots of deer and possum, and you see those on the pretty much daily, little chipmunks and scurrying across the road, and snakes. And so I think it's a very beautiful area. But unfortunately, just maybe 5 minute drive from my house, you know, there used to be a coal mine there, and they had like the largest coal mining disaster in Ohio, happened there. And it's no longer, you know, functioning at this time. It's well past its glory years, but, overall it's a really, quaint community, and we've got wonderful neighbors and, just beautiful land.
So 350 people. So how spread out is everyone? Are you relatively close to your closest neighbors, or is it really kind of quite, a distance between people?
It varies. I mean, I have a neighbor who's fairly close to me. He actually built the home that I live in, which we purchased from him when we moved here in, I think, 2015. Well, I moved here in 2015, but bought the land and the property in 2016. But then you have some neighbors who are, you know, miles away. Most of it, it's just kind of sporadic. Some people will have, you know, 80 acres or so, and their house is tucked away in the holler, and you can't even see the house from the road. Other people you can see, because it's so many ridges there, and some people will just find the tiniest little sliver of flat land just the side of the road, and you know, they have their home built right there. So yeah, it's both. It's some people are right next door, and other people are, you know, have a lot of acreage around them to, you know, kind of buffer them from neighbors.
Mm. So there's no coal mining there at all anymore. No active kind of mining.
There is one. Well, back up. Basically, this my first book, Black Diamonds, was photographed in the region that we here in this region, and it was, the locals referred to it as the Little Cities of Black Diamonds. So within that region, there were several tiny little coal mining towns, their boom towns, that had popped up during the heyday. So each town essentially kind of had some degree of mining there. But currently today, there is one, maybe two, but one definitely that I know of that's still actively mining in a town called Corning. But that's exchanged ownership several times over the past few years. So, and certainly, you know, the production is decreased, you know, extensively since the glory years. But as far as I know, those are the last places that are still mining. There may be a surface mine somewhere nearby, but I'm not 100% positive on that.
Mm. What other stuff goes on in terms of, you know, how people earn a living there, though? Is there an economy based on any particular kind of activities?
Well, Millfield, where I live, and all those other little cities are located probably between 15 to 40 minutes away from the university, which is the town I'm in right now. It's Athens, Ohio. They have Ohio University here. So I would say that a large majority of the communities come into town and to work for the university, but outside of that, it would be like most typical small towns where you have people working in trades. Some people will commute all the way up to Columbus, Ohio, which is about about an hour to hour and 20 minutes drive north of us. So there will be a lot of commuting. And then, of course, there are the people who unfortunately don't have the benefits of owning a vehicle or have the resources to really pursue any type of work outside of where they're living. So it's a very much lower income area for some people.
Yeah. So I wanted to kind of dig into how you came to settle there, because I think that in itself is obviously a part of your story, Rich. But we should may as well go back to the beginning, because I'd like to hear about how your kind of, you know, journey into photography happened. And your dad was in the Navy, so I'm assuming you did a lot of moving around when you were young.
Most definitely. We moved from, but not as much as I had liked. I was born in Florida, and then we moved to, he got stationed in Virginia, then he was stationed in Mississippi, so he spent some time in the Deep South, and then from there we had the opportunity to move either to Anchorage, Alaska, or Guam. I really wanted to move to Guam. I remember this being a child, I thought it was exciting, it sounded so interesting and fascinating, and I enjoyed the moves. But both my parents really liked being in Virginia, because I'd been there previously, so we moved back to Virginia. And I ended up spending most of my life in Virginia.
Mm. And then, because your origins are Mexican, Filipino.
My mother is Otomi Indian, which is the indigenous tribe of Mexico. And my father is Filipino. He immigrated to the States after joining the Navy. So he left his country, came to the States, and then they ended up meeting, of all places, in a Filipino restaurant in Long Beach, California.
All right. That's great.
Yeah.
So I guess, like, now, one thing that happened for you early is you had a kid very young.
Yes.
That must have had a fairly kind of profound impact. I think you're only 17. Mm-hmm. I guess when that happens at that stage, you know, everything suddenly gets turned on its head. What was that experience like for you at that point?
Well, at the time I didn't realize it, but I think in hindsight, I think what had happened is, you know, my family had gone through some domestic turmoil, my mother and father's relationship towards my teen years. And during that time frame, this is what I kind of concluded, you know, as an adult, and looking back on it, I think I was looking for some form of stability, or perhaps a family of my own. I don't think that I was necessarily, you know, aware of that need or desire at the time. But so I ended up having that my daughter Amber at, you know, 17, and I was still in high school. For me, because of that mindset, I almost welcomed it. It didn't create a fear in me, and maybe part of that's can be contributed to being so naive and not knowing exactly what is involved when you have a child and how that affects one's life and also affects the child's life that hasn't been born yet. But I remember being 100% just ready. Let's do this. Had really no fear at all. And I actually ended up, at the time I was failing out of high school. So I, realized that if I didn't finish up that year, that I would more than likely never return to school and to finish my diploma. So I ended up taking like Seven Bells straight, and I did night school, and then I did summer school and finished up out of summer school and graduated and applied for an apprenticeship at the shipyard, the local shipyard, to be an electrician apprentice. And I was ready, you know, I was like, okay, let's do this. Let's get a place. We'll start our family. But, you know, that relationship, unfortunately, at the time, you know, didn't, you know, I was 17 and the mom was 18, you know, and having so much, this magnitude of life-changing experience happening to us, I think may have been too much to handle. And we ended up not, you know, staying together. And at that point, then everything started to crumble for me mentally. So, you know, it was kind of regrouping and trying to figure out what to do next. So that's really the conflict of it all really happened to me, not so much about having the child so young, but was more of what happened afterwards.
The breakup of that relationship was more of a a trauma for you. Then, I mean, it's amazing that you had the maturity to sort of at least kind of accelerate your high school kind of progress, just because you knew that if you didn't get that out of the way, like if you didn't get done, it was not going to happen.
Oh yeah, for sure.
So yeah, and what do you think? You know, you've taken forward into life from the experience of having, because I can't even begin to imagine. I mean, at 17, I was like a baby, basically. I mean,
yes,
really,
a
child. Yeah. And I don't think my head would have just, well, there's no way I could have even imagined it. But yeah, it's extraordinary that, to think that you did take it on, as it were. I guess maybe it's partly, it helps to not really know what you're letting yourself in for, maybe.
Yes, and I think that's true, rings true with a lot of things in life. It's, you know, hopping into a situation and not really knowing. I think ignorance can be bliss sometimes. Mm-hmm. And that actually, you know, that applies to a lot of things that I've done in life where I didn't really recognize the degree of my decision-making was going to lead me to. But in a way, that's good, because I wouldn't have taken a lot of chances that I did.
Yeah.
So.
And how old's Amber now?
She will be 31 in July.
Jeez. Okay.
Yeah.
There you go.
And my son, though, my son is 17. He's my age when I had her.
Okay.
And I look at him often, and I just look at him and shake my head, and I think to myself, like, what the hell was going on in your head? And like, you were this guy's age, and you had a child, and then I think, like, what were my parents thinking? Like, it's just like,
yeah,
I don't know.
Extraordinary.
Yeah.
So, like, when did the photography start? Because I've heard you sort of refer to yourself as having had a kind of blue-collar start, as it were. What did you do to begin with? And then when did you sort of discover photography as a kind of potential, way to move on from that?
Photography, you know, it's kind of, I feel like it's sort of always been present in my life to some degree. And I credit that to skateboarding. I started skateboarding when I was 12. And it just kind of came hand in hand. I think that traditions you can carry on today with a lot of skateboarders, that you're constantly, as you're documenting or photographing, or nowadays people are, you know, doing more videos of their friends when they go out skating. And for me, you know, I don't really know why, but I always felt compelled to photograph my friends as they were skateboarding. And, you know, we were broke back then. So I remember I had a camera. So my other close friend of mine, we would go in on the film, or I would buy film, or he would buy film, and then the other person would pay for it to be processed. And we would share the camera. I would shoot some, he would shoot some. And I even went on to make like a little, you know, back then they had like the punk zines, punk skate zines were kind of a thing happening then. I think they're kind of having a rebirth now. But so I was, my daughter Amber was still, you know, I was still skateboarding. She had been born, and we put out this little zine. Me and my friend put a zine out with pictures we had taken, and put a couple issues out, and then, you know, life kind of took over, and I put the camera down and started working, doing blue collar work, and just kind of forgot about it. Forgot that, you know, it was part of something that I did, because it wasn't anything I made a conscious effort, like, I'm going to go make some photographs of my friends today. It was just something I did. But, I think in my late 20s. I think I was 27 or 28 or something like that. I ended up a little bit before that, I ended up going back to school. I'd been doing tree work and tree removals, things like that. Was the longest job I had as far as for blue collar work. And then among, you know, a ton of other jobs that I was doing, but that was my main one. And I remember I was always talking about going back to school someday for, you know, university. And I remember my boss at the time was up in a tree. I guess we were talking and something came up about going to university, and he barked down at me that I was never going to go to university and that all I do is talk about it and, you know, basically calling me out. And it kind of hit me. I was like, man, I cussed out, you know, inside. I was like, F this guy. And so I was like, but I knew it was kind of right, you know, so I started trying to get funding, tried to get financial aid to go back to school. And I ended up getting it eventually and left the job and went back to it was the local community college, and I was actually just studying. First, I was studying English, as I wanted to be a writer. And I think after my first creative writing class, I was like, no, this is not going to happen. Because I have a tendency, like if I don't excel at something quickly from the get-go, I kind of just lose interest and move on. But at the same time, I was taking a philosophy course, and I fell in love with philosophy, and I ended up double majoring in philosophy, religious studies. And I was about to transfer over to a four-year university, and they said, well, go ahead and get your fine art credit out of the way. And that way, when you get over here, then you can just kind of hit the ground running. And so I signed up for sculpture, and I remember going to the Visual Arts Center to start attending classes and get that credit out of the way. And the lady's like, oh, sorry, it's been canceled. And I was like, oh, man, but I need this credit. And she goes, we've got photography. And I was like, oh, I don't want to do photography. And it wasn't because I wasn't interested in photography. In fact, I had just bought like a little Canon AE-1 from my brother-in-law. But it was more that I knew I was putting myself through school, and I knew that meant, you know, chemicals and paper and film. And I just knew that. And with sculpture, I was like, oh, I can get wood, or I can find objects, and it's all free. I can make it all on my own. But
that's, yeah, you know, yeah. Photography is going to incur some cost right there.
Yeah. Yeah, and I was just trying to get my fine art credit out of the way and move on. But I ended up taking photography because that was, you know, take it or leave it. And I started doing a bunch of street photography. Of course, I didn't know that's what it was at the time. To me, it was just, you know, making photographs out in the street and walking around. And I remember I did a series on some portrait series of people out in the street. And then there was a local juried exhibition at the museum, and black and white was one of the categories, and I was shooting black and white film at that time. And I think my professor and a few of my classmates were like, oh, you should enter. And this is my first photo class. And I was like, no, I don't think so. I was like, plus you have to frame everything. And I said, I don't have money for frames. And my friend, fortunate enough, has worked at a framing shop, and he was in the class. He goes, hey, I'll hook you up. He goes, we've got extra frames sitting around and glass. He's like, just print it out, and I'll frame it up and enter. And I was like, really? He's like, yeah. I was like, all right. So I entered, and I ended up getting first place in black and white portrait series, which I was just kind of baffled. I was like, what the hell is happening? So yes.
But like, so amazing how these kind of weird little random kind of twists of fate and little kind of interventions from the universe that kind of put you on these paths, the way those things come together. I've heard so many great stories talking to everyone on the podcast about how these things happen. It sounds like the same for you. That yeah. bloke up the tree who was your boss, I guess, goading you mm-hmm. into action, that was one there, right there.
Yeah. You know,
just that he probably pissed you off by the fact that he was, you know, almost challenging you.
Yeah.
But then, so like, and you know, you kind of the traveling or the moving around, which you kind of, I guess, had experienced young, you even once you were an adult, that continued to be a thing for you. I know you lived in the UAE for a while, didn't you?
Yes. And that came about, actually, I was, at the time I was working as a photojournalist at a paper in Virginia. And my friend had just moved out to Abu Dhabi and had a position. And so I was always looking at the different job listings, and I still do that today, just to keep a pulse on the industry, to kind of see where things are at. I'm not looking for a new job. Really, again, it's just to stay informed of what's, you know, what the industry is looking like and trends and so forth. So I remember that particular night I was looking at the job listings, and I saw one pop up in Abu Dhabi, and I thought it was my friend's job, and he had just been there maybe a month or two. So I was concerned. So I think I either texted him or emailed him or something, and he pinged me right back. He's like, no, that's not my job, because we're actually hiring for another position. He's like, but you should apply. He's like, but you missed the deadline. It was today, because I guess they're like a whole day, like a day ahead of us in the States. So he goes, but you should still send your portfolio and your, you know, all your information and tell them that, you know, I sent you. And I got off the phone and told my wife, was like, so what'd he say? And I told her, and she goes, you're going to apply, right? And I was like, no. I was like, I'm happy here. And And but she had been wanting us to move abroad because she had been watching the economy and was predicting that the U.S. Was going to go belly up. And I was just kind of, you know, I would listen to what she had to say, but I kind of didn't, you know, I was like, okay, sure, you know, and just kind of we entertained the idea of moving to different places, but I wasn't 100% sold on it. And she said, well, just go ahead and apply. And I was like, all right, fine. So I kind of threw a portfolio to get, not at my portfolio, but I threw a cover letter and typed up my resume really quickly that evening and sent it out. And then a couple weeks later, I got an email asking for an interview and ended up getting that job. And the day I was on I remember the day I was in the airport, I looked up at the TV and they announced Lehman Brothers, the fiasco of Lehman Brothers was announced and the market tanked. And my wife was right. I ended up spending the next 3 years making a great living in the UAE.
It must have felt like you were literally leaving the sinking ship right there, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
The economy went to shit. That's
it
interesting.
Did. And I was ever since then, I've definitely like taken more value and listened a little closer to my wife's insight.
She was right. Yeah, they usually are.
Yeah, they are, I know.
So like, was that a bit of a culture shock then to spend time there in the Middle East from where you were, you know, used to being?
I mean, yes and no. I think it wasn't so much so because in the UAE, you know, everything's in Arabic and in English. So it's pretty easy to navigate. It's not like going to Italy or you know, places
sure.
like that.
But just in terms of the sheer kind of difference in the way that people live and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I mean, there definitely was a lot of cultural adjustments to be made. I think some of the biggest ones were just, there felt like there was this socioeconomic totem pole. And, you know, if you were from this country, you were a service worker. If you're from this country, you were a cab driver. And I didn't really particularly enjoy the way certain people from different countries were treated. And there's not really anything you can do about it as an expat. So that was took a little adjusting and you know.
That's almost like the very kind of diametrical opposite to the American way, you know, which is all about the possibility of, you know, kind of moving from one socioeconomic group to another. Whereas it sounds like you're saying that it's much more delineated there. Like, you know, if, as you say, if you are in a particular group, it's very difficult to move out of it. Whereas America is, you know, famously all about the very opposite thing. That's quite interesting.
Yeah, so that was one part. But on the flip side, though, there was a lot of positive experiences there that for certain the U.S. could learn from. One of those would be the universal health care, that system that they had there, which was amazing. And I really wish that all Americans could experience that for once, at least once in their lifetime, just so that they could come back to the States and understand that it actually is functional. It does work.
And, oh, yeah.
Yeah. So don't get me started on that. But
we have that too.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's not perfect, but nothing is. But yeah.
Yeah.
It's certainly, yeah. I certainly appreciate it. That's for sure. So like then, now you did end up going back to, obviously you went back to the States. And then how did you end up in Ohio there? Specifically in such a small and rural environment.
Yeah, well, I ended up, my wife and I decided we didn't want to raise our children in the South. I grew up in the South and she grew up in LA. And they were getting to an age where they're going to be a lot more impressionable. And I really wasn't fully aware of all the idiosyncrasies of coming from the South and the things that people who don't, haven't grown up there, the things that they may see that a local or native from that area just kind of have become accustomed to. So because of that, you know, my wife was really just like encouraging us to like find somewhere else to live that had a community that would fit, that aligned more with our values. And so I actually attended Ohio University here in Athens, Ohio as an undergrad. And so I was familiar with the town, and we drove through here on a road trip, and our kids had a chance to see, you know, the area. So as we decided we were going to have a lifestyle change, one, just to live somewhere with a different community, and two, we wanted to be somewhere where land was affordable, but where there's also decent education system and also just more like-minded people. And we wanted it ideally to be in a mountainous area, or at least with some foothills or something like that around. So we kind of had this checklist, and as the photojournalism industry was beginning to really see a decline in stability, we just felt like it was time to leave that industry and, you know, just find employment somewhere else. So academia seemed like a solid, you know, base to start with. So we, you know, I started applying all throughout the U.S. and this job ended up, well, my original job when I came here for popped up. It was in marketing communications for the medical school. And I was going down their checklist, and like everything, it was almost like the job was like custom designed for me, because I had, had these just random, you know, items that they wanted you to meet. And I was like, that's so bizarre. Like, just so I applied and ended up getting the job. And when we moved here, you know, I really wanted to live out in the country, because I was kind of done with having neighbors. And I just felt like there's more opportunity being out in the country. It's just kind of secluded, and you can, still being a skateboarder now, like I knew I could build whatever I wanted there. Like, I could build a ramp, I could build a pool. And then in Millfield, strangely enough, there's like two backyard pools that have been built for skateboarding, and then my ramp, and then there's another ramp right down the street. So it was kind of a tight little, you know, community, and there were skateboarders there. And so I said, yeah, this is the place. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and so we found this house, and it's like kind of a little cabin on steroids, and had some acreage, and, you know, and I just went and saw it, and like, this is it.
Yeah. It certainly sounds quite appealing. I guess, you know, if you're a city person, that remoteness or maybe the kind of scale of it might be a bit daunting. I don't know. But you were willing, or you were kind of resigned to just basically quitting photography at that point. I mean, I guess you'd had many years as a jobbing photojournalist at that point, but were you really, you know, quite happy to just kind of hang up your camera?
Yeah, I mean, I just felt like I was happy with what I had done in my career as working as a full-time photojournalist. I felt like I had reached, you know, a point where I was like, okay, you know, this is where I'm at, and I'm satisfied with that. And I felt like the only other vertical moves I could make would be to go from the paper I was at to like New York Times, possibly the LA Times, but probably really just the New York Times, I felt like was the only paper that would really make a difference in allowing my career to develop as a photojournalist. And I just didn't think that was going to be something that happened. And not only that, I didn't necessarily want to move to New York anyway. So it wasn't something I was willing to pursue or to strive for. And again, like I said, I just felt like the industry didn't have a whole lot to offer anymore. So I thought, well, there were a few other Metro papers that were being considered, but in the end, I felt like, well, why leave this sinking ship to jump on a bigger sinking ship? And I didn't want to uproot my children again. And I felt like it was time to like bring them somewhere where they could plant some roots and start building long-term relationships for themselves. And also, my wife had really been hugely supportive through my whole career, and every two or three years we moved as a photojournalist, and there was never any pushback. It was always 100% support. So I just felt like it was my turn to kind of give back to my family and move forward and make decisions, not just for myself, but what would be best for all of us. And and I always have worked on my own personal projects. Even when I was working full time as a photojournalist, I always had something on the side I was doing. So there wasn't a question or concern with myself, like, well, what will you do as a photographer? Because I knew I would find something on my own if I decided that's what I wanted to do. But coming to Ohio, I did take a 2-year break from photography and didn't do it, make any images for myself during that whole time frame because, you know, you do work as, I think when you work in any kind of career for 15 plus years, you know, your identity is kind of defined by that career. So here I am, you know, boom, I'm in rural Ohio and doing communications and marketing. And I was like, okay, what do you want to do now? You know, but I didn't feel pressure. I didn't feel like I had to build my career anymore. I didn't, as a photographer, I didn't feel like I had anything to prove to anyone. I didn't have anything more importantly, I didn't have anything I needed to prove to myself about my work. And I just figured, you know, let's see how it goes. And I actually really enjoyed the freedom of working 8 to 5 Monday through Friday. I was present for my family and I was living out in the country and I was, you know, working the land there and actually getting to skateboard more and just do things that, and spend time with my family and just do things that were not as frequent when I was working as a journalist, and especially when I was, before I was a staffer, I was also freelancing. So it was like constantly hustling. So I embraced it. And also it gave me time to, most importantly, it gave me time to define like what type of work I did want to do when I returned to photography.
Yeah, I mean, it feels like all those things that you're talking about are just, you know, collectively so much more conducive to a creative kind of place to be, you know, in your head, that it's almost like, you know, you had the perfect recipe in a way, because when you are hustling and working and trying to earn a living, it's really, I mean, we all know this, I mean, it comes up all the time, but we all, you know, trying to find time and sort of mental bandwidth to then make your own work is not easy. So it seems like you go in there was, you know, and making those decisions was you know, well, I think you said it was leaving photojournalism felt like one of the best choices you'd made in your life. But then, of course, the creative kind of impetus just, it never kind of goes away, right?
No, how did, definitely not. How,
when you, your first book, Black Diamonds, which is what we're about to sort of, I guess, talk about, is comprised of pictures that you took there. And as you say, you'd had a 2-year hiatus, but how did it kind of start happening again?
Well, I started I think about a year and a half or so in, I was starting to think that, you know, I should make some photographs again. And, but I really just wasn't motivated enough. But I think a lot of people maybe do this. I bought one camera and I loaded some film in it and, I didn't shoot one frame. So that thing's still sitting. It's still sitting in its case, with that same roll of film in it. And I just put it aside and I'm like, okay, whatever. And, went back to doing my thing. And then I really did start seeing photographs again. Sometimes I can turn it off, but, other times it's just, there's a photo, there's a photo, there's a photo. And, you're seeing them everywhere. And when that spark kind of rekindled in me, I bought another camera and, I had brought it with me everywhere, started carrying it with me wherever I was at going. And then I ran into, a person that, you know, leaving my doctor's office and ended up making a portrait of that person and looked at the photo, the shoot, and looked at the photograph, and that one photograph, I knew, you know, that there was something happening again. And and then from there, I was like, okay, it's on. And I just started making work and not really knowing what it was going to be, but I did start making photographs again. And that was like 2 years on.
Can you talk a little bit more about that particular picture? It feels like it's a key shot, let's put it that way. Mm-hmm. I mean, apart from the fact that it drew you back in a way, it was the first picture you'd taken after that break. Right. But it's a portrait of a guy called Eric.
Yes.
And, you know, it's immediately arresting because he's got, you know, tattoos on his face and piercings and stuff. And the word damaged is written across his forehead. So, you know, it's pretty extreme in that sense. How did you come across this guy?
Like I mentioned before, I was coming out of the doctor's office, though, and we kind of made eye contact when you pass a stranger and you nod or you say hello. So we kind of did that. We, you know, made eye contact, nodded, and, you know, both of us were making our way to our cars. And I got in my truck and my camera was sitting there, and that was the first day actually that I started bringing my new camera with me, with the intention that I would start making portraits and pictures of people and things when I came across them. And so then I had like this quick conversation in my head. I was talking myself out of photographing him, and then I was talking myself into it, out of it, into it, out, back and forth, and then really just kind of cussing at myself internally for not stepping up to, you know, get out of the truck and do this. And finally, it's like, all right, man, like just do it, you know, get it together. So I grabbed my camera and like,
it's really interesting that you had that tussle.
And it never goes away. It started from day one and it keeps going. But I just hopped out and went to his car and like knocked on his window and gave him a quick pitch, and he said sure, and he hopped out and, where do you want to do it? And I kind of had an idea where, and I kind of gave him some direction and started making some frames. And during that time, then like this tear started coming down his eye, and I didn't stop because I didn't want to ruin, you know, the serendipity of the moment. And I stopped when I was done, when I thought that I had gotten what I needed, and he just like hopped off. He was standing on a curb, so he hopped off the curb and was like, I've got to go, because it was really cold that day, and we were both actually pretty cold. And he goes, all right, it's cold. And he just shuffled off to his car, and I went after him and said, wait, let me get your name, and and gave him my info or whatever. And then, you know, like I said, I went and processed those pictures, and I just knew immediately, like, that was it. And
I mean, at some point, you know, it became, I guess, an exploration of the place that you were living in. But like, at what point did you start to think of it in terms of, you know, making a body of work that was sort of coherent?
I think I might have been shooting a few months on it at some point, and I was looking at the work and was shooting on it, and a couple of things happened, you know, because first of all, I wasn't confident that what I was doing was working, all these different photographs and things like that, because I was going around, I was taking portraits and doing a little bit of street photography, a little bit of new topographic style work, still lives, just kind of just gathering everything, anything that I responded to, I was photographing. And then around 3 months in, I think the Washington Post, an editor from the Washington Post, reached out to me and was interested in, because I was posting the images on a separate account dedicated just to that work, and that was my way of kind of Instagram account. And that was my way of kind of like seeing daily, like kind of what I was doing, because I posted every day for like a year of different work that I was doing on this project. But he reached out and wanted to do something, you know, on the piece. And I was kind of reluctant because I didn't feel like I really even knew exactly where I was going with it or what it was going to be. And I also had concerns about how the edit would be. I didn't want it to be edited in a way that would reflect negatively on my community. So we talked through all that and kind of expressed my concerns, and he, you know, respectfully like kind of went with it and ended up running a piece on it. And then at that point, I thought, and then I think Feature Shoot reached out shortly after that as well, and were interested in it. And so then I was like, okay, well, maybe something's going on here, because again, like I said, I wasn't fully confident in the work just because it was a definite aesthetic change from the work I was doing as a photojournalist. Because I don't have any of that work on my website anymore, but that work tended to be more contrasty and saturated in color and really extreme blacks and midtones. And this new work was like kind of deadpan, you know, even lighting, just almost a 180 from what I'd been doing before. So I really didn't know if it was going to resonate with people. But at that point, I just, you know, it's like, okay, something's happening here. So then I did a tighter edit with my wife and a couple of my close friends who I trusted their opinion. And kind of realized, you know, these are the common threads that are happening throughout the work. And that allowed me to kind of focus in on, you know, take more of a direction and take more of a, an opinion or a point of view on what I was trying to communicate.
At that point, were you feeling like part of that community, or were you still kind of trying to find your way in, as it were, as a kind of someone who, you know, only been there for a relatively short period of time?
No, I was feeling great about the community at that point. I was super excited about it every day, going out and making images, and just everything was resonating with me. It was like being in a Disney movie and all the birds are chirping.
Yeah.
But then at one point I did have this run in with this woman, and I made a portrait of her and her daughter, and then both of them separately, and, you know, got their information and gave them mine and said I would, you know, send them some outtakes of the work. And then all of a sudden, I think a few days later, there a post on a local Facebook page for, I think it's called Mama Friends. It's just for local women that are mothers. And it kind of started going viral. It basically described me to the T, what I was driving, what I was wearing, saying that I was like a predator on her and her children. And it was really bad, but I kind of ignored it because I was like, oh, whatever. But then I went back and checked it again, my wife went back and checked it, and it was going viral. Like, it, you know, for a local community, it was going viral, and it's just small communities. And at that point, I raised concern because I said, you know, well, I'm pretty easy to identify here, and I stand out. So I was just like, oh man, you know, this could be bad. I could be in a situation where people see me and confront me and want to, you know, turn to, you know, some type of physical violence. And I just wasn't, you know, wasn't ready to invite that into my life. So I actually went to the local state police station in that town, because in the post it said she reported it to the police and, you know, told everyone in her community to look out for me. And so I actually went there. I brought my daughter there as like my like safeguard to kind of like smooth the edges out a little bit, because I look a little bit gruff, you know, here and there. And like, so she and I went, and I gave him my card. I gave him my, you know, sample of the work I do. I gave him, like, you know, the emails that went back and forth between myself and the woman who I had photographed, and like all the screenshots of the posts and things, and just say, hey, I just want to let you know, this is who I am. This is what I do. If you have any problems, like, reach out to me. And, so there was that scenario. But overall, I mean, that was like, you know, that was like the one thing that kind of,
it's a very weird reaction, because she, obviously, you know, she'd already agreed to be photographed, and so she, it was almost like she'd done a complete, some kind of strange kind of mental gymnastics in sort of misrepresenting who you were.
Yeah, it was very bizarre. And actually, I remember after that happening, I felt like I mentioned earlier, you know, I felt like I was in a Disney movie, but then when that happened, I really felt deflated and really discouraged. Nothing like that had ever happened to me before, you know, as a photographer. And I felt like I had to do something, you know, to get my confidence back. So I immediately like went out to make images later that afternoon, but I didn't photograph any people. I was just photographing like relics and landscapes and things. And then as I was driving, I was like, all right, man, you got to at least try to photograph one person, because you got to get past this. Because I was mentally, I just wasn't there anymore. Like, wasn't where I needed to be. So, but I knew like the only way to get past it was to like just, you know, push through it with making images again and connecting with the people in the community. So I actually ended up turning down this road and ran into this other gentleman who was also in the book. And he's a photograph of a man with this big white beard. And he's got like a camouflage shirt on with a little deer on it. And I saw him at the end of this lonely road with his truck. And I was like, but he looks so great to photograph. And I was like, oh my gosh, all right, let's do this, you know. And he waved, which is, you know, which is pretty common out in the country. People do wave, but he waved. And I was like, okay, that's my in. So I made the images of him and hung out and talked for a while. And that kind of brought me back to where I needed to be.
Yeah, cool. Yeah, because I mean, I've got to, I have to describe you physically to some extent here, Rich, if you don't mind me doing that, because
I'm short, dark, and handsome, all that, and then some. No,
you are distinctive because you've got quite a lot of tattoos yourself. You've got one really across, right, all the way across your throat. It's really quite a large one. I don't know if it's a word. Is it? Does it say something?
Yeah, it says faith. It's
Oh, faith. Okay, yeah. So, you know, I guess in some ways, I suppose it might help you to blend into certain kinds of environment, a bit like, you know, Eric in the car park with his tattoos. But I suppose some people might see it as, find it, I don't know, slightly intimidating to some extent. Although you've also got a very friendly face, I have to say. So, you know, there's a kind of a combination of things. The other thing, well, I guess the context in which you took these pictures, of course, was that it was 2016 or so. It was Trump and all that was going on, you know, at the same time. A huge kind of sea change in American history, really, and in politics. And it was a very weird thing for us all to go through, for the world to go through.
Yes.
For you guys actually there, living through it every day. But did that play into the work, or was that just kind of a bit of a secondary thing for you in terms of the kind of narrative?
I want to say it was secondary, because the first part was really just getting to know my community and finding out where I was living and finding my place within that community. But at the same time, I mean, so that was really my main motivator, but at the same time, a lot of this was happening with Trump, and there were instances for me where I was like questioning my safety, especially immediately after the elections, you know, and there was an increase in violence against people of color in the States for like no reason, no real given reason other than, you know, the climate was changing politically and socially. So having not explored my community outside of Athens, Athens is a much more liberal town. So outside of that, I really didn't know, you know, what was I safe? Was my family safe? Could I, you know, exist without worrying about looking over my shoulder? But I think that's kind of a natural behavior pattern for me in general, no matter where I live, just because racism exists everywhere. So that's just kind of like being a person of color in general, not just myself, but all people of color, typically, no matter where they are existing and living, what have to behave in a manner where they're, you know, looking over their shoulder or speaking in a certain way to receive approval or dismissal from where their community or who they're surrounded by. So, but that being the case and being here in rural, even a much more rural and isolated area, it seemed to magnify it to some degree. So yeah, I wanted to go out there, and I also knew that there were, you know, factors such as in sociopolitical factors that were happening in the country. So, but I didn't want to blame one thing or another or judge a community on what I was seeing in the news. I wanted to find out for myself and make my own judgment call on my own experience. But I certainly think as time passed, and even more so after I did make the images, we did reach a kind of a climax in locally where I shot most of these images. And then when I was done, I didn't go back out making images for a while in the community. And then when I did go back out to some of these places, a lot more Trump signs had popped up. I don't know that that would have changed anything as far as my personal experience. I don't think people would either have been receptive or not. I'm not sure how that might have changed. But, you know, I had a positive experience.
Yeah, because I don't know if we've even made it explicit, but for people who aren't, you know, don't really know that much about the geography of the US, we're talking about Appalachia here, and that's a kind of word that triggers all kinds of, I suppose, cliches, and it feels like it photographically it's been extensively explored as a very sort of white working class, often portrayed as kind of economically deprived area. These are all things that kind of come to mind, even for someone like me sitting here in London. But I don't know if you were therefore more acutely aware of the need or of a desire to not kind of perpetuate and too many of these kind of cliched views of what that area is all about.
Yeah, I mean, when I first moved here, I wasn't as aware. I mean, I had lived here before as a student, but I wasn't necessarily aware of all of the stereotypes that come along with photography in Appalachia. It wasn't really on my radar in the sense of like how sensitive of an issue is to photograph in this region. And then as I started making work here, I think a few books had come out, not photo books, but like, I think Hillbilly Elegy was one of them, which got a lot of, kickback from all people in the Appalachian community. You know, felt like it was a huge misrepresentation of this region. So at that point, I started reading more books and literature. One book I read was like, What You're Getting Wrong About Appalachia, and just kind of trying to get a better sense of, you know, what stories had been told, what were positive about them, what were negative about them, and at that point really tried to be very careful about how I portrayed the region. And also, from a photo perspective, I'd seen a lot of the photography that had been done around here, and I just felt like, you know, there's a ton of stuff done in this region about the opioid crisis, ton of stuff done about the poverty here. And those were definitely two things that I chose not to focus on. Obviously in the imagery, you can tell that it's a lower income community, but that's not what the foundation of the work is about. And I just felt like that story had just been told, those stories had been told enough, and I didn't feel like I wanted to add to that conversation. So I wanted to think about how could I share something insightful and different than what's already been told, but at the same time respecting my community and keeping the dignity of the people that were in the images.
Have you had an opportunity to sort of show the pictures to the people in them, or to kind of even show it to the wider community? It feels like, you know, you ought to have an exhibition in that area or something.
Yeah, the book came out in last year. So as COVID is kind of, you know, been kind of up and down, you know, a lot of the places that you would be doing, showing your work locally, you know, it just wasn't an opportunity that I wanted to take on, just because I felt like I was going to put this show together and nobody would really get to see it. Some people certainly have seen the work, like Eric, for example, has seen the work, and I keep trying to get him to get back to me because I want to give him a book, and he's not on Facebook a whole lot. That's the only way we've been communicating. Like I'll send him an email, maybe 3 months later he'll message me back, and then I'll say, well, let me get the book to you, and then maybe in 3 months he'll get back to me and I can get it to him. But I'm trying. But the response overall, not just locally, but the response locally and regionally has been pretty positive. I've gotten calls literally from people I've never talked to or known, from all up and down the Appalachian Mountains, telling me how much they appreciate the work. So that's been very encouraging. So as far as, you know, show, it's something I do want to do. And like, I have this project, Black Diamonds, and then I have the forthcoming book, Little Cities. And then I have a third book that I'm also working on that all kind of ties all three of these bodies of work together. So there's potentially, you might do a show that edits all three bodies of work into one. So, but we'll see.
Well, let's talk about that follow-up then, which is Little Cities. Mm-hmm. Feels like, you know, it's a kind of, what, like you say, maybe we're looking at a trilogy here, and I'll ask you about you know, what else you got forthcoming. But that one is in the pipeline because you're doing a Kickstarter to raise the funds currently, which is the same way you funded Black Diamonds. Mm-hmm. So fingers crossed you'll do that again. Yeah. But tell me a little bit about Little Cities.
It was kind of interesting. I mean, I was making the images that are in that book started when, like, they ran parallel to when I was working on Black Diamonds. So as I was working Black Diamonds, I was photographing a lot of new topographic work, and those were considered to be, you know, potentially part of Black Diamonds. But as Black Diamonds was developing, I was realizing that these photos weren't fitting the overall arching theme of Black Diamond. So I actually created, but I knew there was something there, but I didn't know exactly what it was yet. So I actually had made a gallery at that time, and it was on my website for a little while, but under a different name. And then I took it down and like just put it aside to focus on other things. And then I literally forgot that I had the work. And then one day I was on an assignment, and it asked that I get some imagery that was like showing a sense of place of the region I was photographing in. So I started shooting those, and then I was like, oh, you know, I really would like to do a body of work that focused on showing the story of this place just through the landscape. And then a light bulb went off. I was like, oh wait, you already have that. And so I pulled all my files and started shooting more, and I was looking through it all. It was starting to formulate this narrative, and I was like, there's something here for sure. And at the same time, though, while I was working on Black Diamonds, I also was seeing a lot of imagery that kind of could tie into something about indigenous history and culture. But I didn't shoot any of that because I just didn't. I was like, I'll put that aside and wait, because if there's something there, but I don't know exactly what it is, and I don't want to make those photos yet. So I would just take these mental notes of like where to go back to, and I just or figure out how to put something together with that. So I kept moving forward, and then I had all these images of, that I started shooting on again with little cities and of the landscape and land use. And then I was driving to visit some family in Virginia, and I stopped at my good friend's house in Charlottesville. His name's Matt Eich, and he's the publisher of Little Oak Press, who will be putting out Little Cities. So I go in his house, and I'm showing him the work, and we ended up deciding, like, let's do a little art project together, and let's put this book out. And so we were doing the edit, and actually it was this far along as we're doing the edit, and my wife has always kind of been very involved with my work, but at that time she'd be extremely busy, so I just kind of kept her out of it. So I came home with this new edit of Little Cities, and goes, yeah, this is cool, American dreams, fading, and landscapes, land use, and man-altered landscape. And she's like, but she goes, where are you in this? Like, where are you in this body of work? And it like kind of stopped me down my tracks, because she's really good at doing that too, basically like calling me out and just like no, go back to the drawing board. So so I paused, and I was like, oh damn, okay. And she goes, well, think about it, Rich. She's like, you're talking about the American dream, but like as an indigenous person, like how does this American dream affect you, or how are you a part of this? And and it's an interesting balancing act, because I'm American, but I come from indigenous and Filipino roots or lineage, and a lot of my indigenous history has been lost because it's just not available to me. My grandfather passed away well before I was at the age where I could approach him and realize the value of knowing about our indigenous history. And he didn't speak to my mom, and came from a family of 10 children, and he never was very he was never vocal about the lineage of our family. So that was kind of lost and lost to history. And so as she brought these points up, I said, well, I started thinking about, she mentioned like, well, you should, incorporate this perspective and see how that ties into the overall arch of land use and settler colonialism. And I said, yeah, I agree 100%. But then I wasn't sure, like, what do I photograph? And as I mentioned before, I knew there was some images about Native American history that I wanted to photograph when I was working on Black Diamond. So I went back and revisited those places, and then came back and kind of made some work prints and was trying to see how they would fit into the framework of this, of what I'd been working on. And they weren't quite there. They weren't quite what I wanted. It didn't feel organic. It didn't feel right. And then my wife and I began talking some more, and she's like, well, what about the mounds? And all through this region, there are ancient Indian burial mounds. Many of them have been lost to farming and just development in general. They were just bulldozed and flattened. And then a lot of them, in the farming era, they were just kind of plowed over until they're just very unrecognizable. if you're not looking, know what you're looking for, you won't know that those mounds are there. Mm-hmm. But then there were still some significantly sizable ones left that were protected. So I was like, you know, maybe, I'm not sure though. So I went out and started making images of all these mounds and doing some research and finding out, you know, where they were within my community. And I think I did a few, and then Matt and I met back up again, and I interjected the mounds within the framework of the book. And they act as, I can't say it better, and Matt actually used words, you know, and my wife did as well, is like they kind of punctuate the work throughout the book. So they're not like, they're intentionally placed like within the, it's almost like you've said this sentence with these this post-industrial new topographic work, and then there's a punctuation of this mound, and then it continues through the landscape again, and then another punctuation of the mound. So there's this consistent rhythm and flow that's going through the book. And once we started playing with that, and I started seeing that was working, I really felt like it really elevated the series and added a whole new layer of information and continuity and value to the work.
Yeah. And like, there's no people at all in this work, so I assume that's right. A kind of deliberate decision.
It's deliberate, and it's really scary for me.
Why? Why is it scary?
Well, I mean, for example, with Black Diamonds, you know, it's like that. As I mentioned before, I wasn't confident about the work because it was the first time I had deviated from the aesthetic I was shooting as a photojournalist, and the community that knew my work, were familiar with it, were used to seeing it done one way. Then I introduced the Black Diamonds, and then when I go into little cities, I strip everything away, and there are humans. The effects of humans are present, and the story and the history of humans are present in the work, but actual humans are not. So I am interested and slightly anxious to see how that's received by the audience that is familiar with my work, and will it still resonate with them without seeing, without being founded in portraiture and in street photography, and just when I strip all that away from it, because, you know, let's face it, like, new topographic work is not necessarily the most interesting work for everyone who enjoys photography. Not everybody, even admittedly myself, like, you know, maybe 6 years ago, if I had seen a body of work like this, it may not have, you know, been of interest to me because I didn't understand, you know, that approach.
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean. It's a bit sort of sterile, almost forensic. There's a kind of distance, a kind of objectivity to it that's, for a lot of people, I think it doesn't immediately jump out as something of interest, but you've got to kind of get into that way of approaching things, I suppose.
Yeah, so that's the anxiety there.
Yeah, well, yeah, let's see. I think it's good that you've kind of challenged yourself in a way, I'm sure it will prove to be a good exercise to put yourself in that position of vulnerability, perhaps. So, like, now you've got this, you sort of alluded to the idea that maybe this is a sort of trilogy in the making. What is the third element that you're sort of, is the work in progress kind of thing?
The third one, and I don't want to speak too much on it just because I don't want to end up.
Yeah, of course.
Going back and being like saying one thing and then later going, oh wait.
Yeah.
Because what I like about what I'm able to do now is like not working as a photojournalist is that I'm allowed to allow the story to take me and where it wants and reveal to me what it wants to reveal, as opposed to, and I still work, I still take on editorial assignment work and I put a different hat on for that type of photography, but. In this case, I don't have to illustrate somebody else's idea or concept, or I don't have to report on something and make sure the image communicates a specific idea or concept. In this case, in this approach, you really can just let it be whatever it ends up becoming and then learn from that and reflect on it and see the common threads and themes and let it teach you and take you places as opposed to the other way. So that being said, the next project is... the third piece is called the bubble, and there is some of that on my website right now, a small edit of it. But and the overarching theme of what I'm trying to get through there is like during COVID, a lot of people were losing their jobs from the university, myself included. And at that point, and then there was some, and also some of the small businesses uptown on the Court Street, the main street there were closing down, and couldn't sustain themselves economically. And then it dawned on me, you know, as I said earlier, you know, most people in this region tend to work at the university, and I had just done Black Diamonds that was looking at post-industrial coal mining boom towns. And I said, well, wait a second, like Athens is essentially a contemporary company town. Like without the university here, this whole town and the surrounding communities would just cease to exist. There would be no income, no funding, businesses would crumble. So I decided to start making imagery of some of, you know, first it started with just doing topographic work of the image of the town itself. And then I started introducing a lot of students into the work. And then they're also now beginning to be like branching out into like incorporating like people who service these students and serve and manage the town, whether they are maintenance workers or, you know, elementary school teachers or professors and things like that. So, that project I had shot for a year on, and I actually put it aside. I haven't worked on that for any of 2021 because I needed to focus on getting Little Cities completed and out. Mm. So hopefully sometime later this year or maybe early next year, I'll start making some more work for that because it's I've talked through that concept with my wife a little more recently and kind of clarified some things and helped me kind of see new direction to kind of investigate. Because we're kind of at that point in this project where it's like, I've gone out and gathered all this information and on a loose concept and explored visually and just made imagery of whatever resonated with me. And then I set it down and I'm like, okay, I think it's about this or I think it's about that or like, where's it going to take us? And again, like I said, she's very quick to like call me out when, you know, it's not quite... I'm saying is not, you know, being seen in the images. So.
She sounds like a valuable asset, Rich.
Oh, yeah. Man. She's my secret weapon.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, look, mindful of your time, I want to get on and do these bonus questions for the member podcast, if you don't mind. But
sure.
Thank you so much for chatting with me, Rich. It's been really enjoyable to kind of hear more about the work and good luck with Little Cities and the funding and everything.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it. And yeah, crossing my fingers on the next book.